Right. Thank you. I changed my title a little bit. I will talk about observables in flat space, and I'll lead my way to observables or scattering amplitudes in anti-De-Sitter space. First of all, I also want to thank the organizers for giving me an opportunity to come here and present a talk here. It's been a very exciting meeting for me. Okay. So here's the outline for my talk. First, I'll start with a brief introduction to the subject.
Here's Craig. Craig Kameria.
I'll start again. I'll give a brief introduction on the subject. I'll start with the traditional way of calculating scattering amplitudes. And when I'm talking about scattering amplitudes, I'm just talking about scattering amplitudes in flat space, good old Minkowski flat space. And so there are efficient ways of calculating scattering amplitudes in flat space, which goes by the name like these recursion relation. You can calculate this using recursive techniques, and I'll give you an overview of those techniques. And then I'll jump on to scattering amplitudes in anti-De-Sitter space, or what is the analog of what is scattering amplitude in anti-De-Sitter space, which is quite interesting for different reasons, which I will mention. I'll give you a very brief introduction to anti-De-Sitter space, and I'll talk about scattering amplitudes in anti-De-Sitter space, and a particular kind of basis in which we can do calculations, which is known as the Mellin basis. So you have to take this Mellin transform in order to do these calculations, which makes the scattering amplitude sort of crisp, sort of reminiscent of the scattering amplitudes in flat space. So it seems like the Mellin space is sort of a natural space for these amplitudes in anti-De-Sitter space. And so I'll discuss that aspect of these anti-De-Sitter space scattering amplitudes. And then I'll end with some recursion relation techniques that I've been investigating with a student at Hendricks College about using these recursion relations in calculating what is this analog to scattering amplitudes in anti-De-Sitter space, talk about future ideas. And so that's the outline of my talk. So I'll give a bird's-eye view of all these topics that I'm interested in. So let's start with what the scattering amplitude is. So let's start from very basic points. So as you know, high-energy physics, if you want to be a reductionist, high-energy physics is essentially about studying scattering amplitudes for relativistic particles, right? You could have two high-energy particles. They can smash each other, and a multitude of new particles can be created from their relativistic energy. So the most obvious reason, like the most prosaic, most grungy reason to actually calculate the scattering amplitudes is to calculate cross-sections of backgrounds if you're trying to search for new physics in the Large Hadron Collider or similar colliders. We don't know if there's, I mean, the LHC is going to give new data. We don't know if there's going to be supersymmetric particles or things of that sort, but we know that there will be a bunch of QCD backgrounds. So we have to subtract that in order to extract any new physics. So that's the most prosaic, very general reasons why we should be concerned about studying scattering amplitudes. Another less discussed, probably, reason to calculate scattering amplitude is to understand our theories better. So these are the observables of our theories. So we want to understand our theories, the things that we think are good. We want to sort of check them. So there are many questions that people investigate. These are not the questions that I'm thinking about at the moment. But there are questions like, is there an ultraviolet finite theory of gravity? Well, what I mean by UV finite theory of gravity, well, maybe string theory is a UV finite theory of gravity. But is there a UV finite theory of gravity for point particles? A lot of people conjecture that n equals to 8 supergravity might be one of those theories. Okay, so those are the questions that are interesting. And so the way to sort of understand those questions is by studying scattering amplitudes. The other thing that is very interesting is there seems to be a structure of gravity amplitude, which sort of like the structure, the mathematical structure of the gravity amplitude at tree level. At tree level seems to be the square of gauge theory for all loop orders. So it's sort of like related with sort of a duality between closed strings and open string as well. But it also works for a particle like a graviton and gauge theory amplitude. So these are the questions, sort of like interesting formal questions about our theories that we want to sort of investigate, or people are interested in investigating in this line of thought. And so as we know, the traditional way of calculating scattering amplitude is by using Feynman diagrams. So we've been doing this for a long period of time. We calculate these Feynman diagrams, we add them together, and calculate scattering amplitudes. So we start with the Lagrangian, like Mary showed yesterday. We start with the Yang-Mills Lagrangian. And so how do we actually calculate scattering amplitude? We can have a Lagrangian like this. And so you can extract these Feynman diagrams. by putting them in a path integral, do perturbation theory, and derive these Feynman rules. So I'm interested, for the purpose of this talk, some of these structures are generalized into gravitons and things of that sort. But for the purpose of this talk, I'll sort of narrow myself to gluons or gauge bosons. Okay, so here are some of the vertices that come into play when you actually do the perturbation theory. So there's a three-point vertex. So you can have there are colors that are associated with this. There's a structure constant, some g mu nu, which is the metric. So here's the expression that you can get, which corresponds to this Feynman diagram. So that you could have fermions. You could have a contact diagram like this, a propagator. So what you do is to patch these things together, as most of you know already. And so you patch these things together, and you calculate scattering amplitude, right? So here is a four-point gluon amplitude. Simple thing, right? Like you could probably do it in kindergarten. So how do you calculate a four-point gluon amplitude? What does it mean? So it means like you have two gluons going in, then two gluons coming out, right? So how do you calculate this? So first of all, the scattering amplitude is a function of different things. What is it a function of? It's a function of momenta. These are external momenta, k1, I missed a k2 here, k3 and k4. And it's associated with some kind of a polarization vector. It has helicity, so it has positive helicity or negative helicity. And so what you do is you can patch up all the Feynman processes that can occur. So you could have 1, 2, 3, 4. You could have 2, 3, 4, 1. And then you could have 1, 2, 3, 4. There's a contact diagram. There's an additional diagram. Like, so what I'm considering here is just color ordered. You can get the rest of these diagrams by actually changing the permutation a bit. What you do here, like this quantity, which is a color ordered, as you can see, this does not have any color. The color is stripped out. So what you can do is you can add these diagrams together, and like once you add these together, you get an observable. That's a gauge invariant quantity, right? So like a Feynman diagram by itself is not a gauge invariant quantity, and then you have this expression. So like you take, like I mean, you know, like these are three diagrams. You calculate this, maybe a couple hours. Probably some of you can finish it in 20 minutes.
Sure.
Thank you. Yeah. So I need a couple shots of espresso. I probably need it right now to do these calculations. And so once I do this, you know, I feel very good about myself, and I get a simple expression. But then intermediate calculation is actually quite complicated, right? So there are a bunch of these things. Like here's a Mathematica file where I calculated a long time ago. And then you get it as a function of these S12, which is like 2k1 dot k2, some dot product momenta. And then you have these polarization vector. So okay, the intermediate process, the real punchline here is the intermediate process is actually quite complicated. But the answers tend to be quite simple in this game. You could write it down in some other variable, which is known as a spinner helicity variable. And I don't want to go through this, but at least you can agree that I haven't hidden anything here. These are actually very simple expressions. Like you condense it down, you get it in a very simple expression. So like you have all these terms, they add up to a very simple expression. Okay, great. Now in general, like these Feynman diagrams, so you do these calculations for, let's say, okay, two particles going into two particles, simple enough, everybody can do this. But then you can try to calculate, let's say, six-point amplitude, and an expression looks like this. This I borrowed from Tony Z's book, who's also at UCSB. And so here's like each one of these are dot products of these momenta and polarization vectors. And in general, so the first calculations, like one of the non-trivial calculations people did, which needed a supercomputer to calculate, was this heroic calculation on six-point amplitude by Park and Taylor. So they calculate two particles going in, four particles coming out, right? So they thought, okay, so this was necessary. Like they were interested in understanding processes in the collider at the time. And so what they say in this paper is so they have this expression. The first time it was calculated, they probably checked the gauge invariance and things of that sort. And so they know that the answer, they go through the non-trivial check, and they know the answer is correct. But then it was a messy expression. And so what they say towards the end of the paper is quite interesting. I learned this from a talk by Jacob Borgelli. And what they say is details of the calculation together with a full exposition of our techniques will be given in a forthcoming article. Furthermore, we hope to obtain a simple analytic form of answer, making our result not only an experimentalist, but also a theorist's delight. So that was very prescient. And they go and do this calculation in 6 months. And lo and behold, they come up with a very simple, cute answer, right? A very simple expression that can be written down in terms of like these simple expressions. So these are just dot products of momenta, if you're wondering what that was. Okay, so like a lot of these scattering amplitudes, for 6-point amplitude, there seems to be these kind of persistent structure. It's true with, just a bit of an aside, it's also true with graviton amplitude. DeWitt was the first person who worked out scattering amplitudes for gravity. So he has something very similar in his 1967 paper, like two or three companion papers known as quantum theory of gravity. So he's just basically doing scattering amplitudes of graviton. And he says somewhat very similar, like the spirit of this code is quite similar as well. He says the tediousness of the algebra involved, combined with the fact that the final answer is ridiculously simple, leads one to believe there must be an easier way. So this seems to be the structure. Like the gravity amplitude seems to have like a simple, nice expression as well. And so, and that's also true with gauge theory amplitude. So let's just give you an overview of how complicated these Feynman diagrams are in order to actually do these things. For 4-point, two gluons going into two gluons, we have 4 diagrams that are involved. For 5-point, there are 25 diagrams. For 6-point, that's the amplitude that was calculated by Park and Taylor. There's 220 diagrams. For 10 points, there are 10 million diagrams, which also means like there are millions of expressions, millions and millions and millions of expressions. And so this goes faster than factorial rate with an increase of number of particles. But then like a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times when you add these answers up, like the final answer, like each diagram is not something that you can observe. If you want to talk to an experimentalist, you want to actually add them up, get a gauge invariant answer, and then the final answer is actually quite simple. And so the Feynman method, so one wonders after this, is this the efficient way of calculating these, especially for certain kinds of particles like gluons and gravitons. So the question, this begs the question, is there an efficient way? Yes?
This is for tree level?
This is tree level. Now, this is very good. This is very simple tree level diagram. There's not even a loop. Like, so once you have loop, now that's another mess, right? So that's another misery to deal with. But this is at the tree level, like very simple scattering amplitude. Still, a lot of these diagrams that.
And he sums it. It's a complete sum of all the graphs in this case, right?
Yeah.
There's no partial.
Yeah. It's a sum of all the graphs, all the Feynman graphs. Now that's an interesting question because I mean this is a rough sort of estimate because the number of Feynman diagrams that you have to actually add up in any of these processes depends upon the choice of the gauge. And that's part of the reason why these things are actually complicated. Like because like physics in the end is gauge invariant, but you can choose certain kind of gauge to do the calculations. So that's part of the reason. Like, I mean, it's roughly 10 million diagrams, but like when you're like, you know, you can use some other gauge, like let's say background field gauge or something else. Like the answer is going to be simple and, you know, like but then there are a lot of these diagrams that are contributing to these amplitudes. So that's unquestionable. No matter what gauge you choose, it's actually still complicated. So yesterday we were talking over lunch and we were talking about factorization. Don and Nathan and us, we were talking about factorization of S matrix, and it's in the similar spirit of to what I'm going to be talking about. There's something known as a BCFW recursion relation. The question is there an efficient way that we can use in order to calculate these scattering amplitudes? So the way to do these is look at this as a 5-point amplitude. So this is a 5-point amplitude. In other words, there are 5 particles that are involved. And so what you can do is you can shift this, you can deform this, you can have some complex deformation. And this is what BCFW did. BCFW is Brito, Casaggio, Feng, and Witten. And so they deformed this to some complex, they deformed this K1 by K1 plus ZQ. And I'll tell you in a minute what Q is. And K2 is K2 minus ZQ. Okay? And so there's a special property for this Q. It could be a polarization vector for which this Q satisfies the same property as a polarization vector. Once you deform this, you still want these are gluons. So they're massless, so you want to have K1z squared equals 0, K2z squared equals 0, and you want to have one more property that is satisfied, which is Q dot K1 is equal to 0. Once you deform this, this is the constraint that you want to put so that it's still on shell. Okay? So that's why it's called on shell recursion relation. So once you deform this K1 by this this complex parameter z, then you create poles. You create poles in your scattering amplitude. So this is like this, these are. So you can see that K1 is shifted by z and K2 is shifted by g. Okay. Any questions here? So once you shift this K1, yes?
Well, I mean, is this a kind of regularization?
It's not a regularization, because we're talking about just...
it's a trick.
It's a trick.
Is it regularization just a trick? Or, you know, okay.
Regularization is also a trick, maybe.
Touché.
No, it's theoretical physics.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't think of it as like you're trying to sort of...
That's a very good question, actually. So there's a paper by Arkani Hamid and Kaplan. So they try to provide a physical interpretation of this. So the way they think about this is, like, we have these gluons that are scattering. These are gluons that are scattering. So what is this ZQ that I've added? So you can think of this, and I don't know if this is the most, like, this is probably the most physical way of thinking about this. You can think of this K1, this ZQ that is actually, these are just ZQs, like some momentum, which is like which has sort of high energy behavior in a way, and it's actually propagating, or it's traveling in a gas of gluons, so that helps in factorization. So there's a nice paper on this, and so they use like some other gauge to explain this. I can't quite remember exactly what their argument is, but they think of this K1 like that I've shifted, and K2 that I've shifted as some particles in a gas of gluons.
Dressing?
What does that mean?
I mean, are you dressing?
No.
No, but you're not saying it's like
you're just
dressing.
Trying to probe the analytic structure of the
I'm just trying to probe, like, yeah, it's, okay.
So you're deforming the variable so you can get insight into the analytic structure.
Okay. So it's, in a way, like, this sort of reminds some of you probably of the S-matrix program in a way, right?
Yeah,
so like the difference between the S-matrix program and this is that here we're looking at massless particles. There, they were actually worried. They were thinking about pi and scattering, and so like that's another moral of the story in a way that so massless particles, gravitons and gluons seem to be the simplest sort of particles to deal with. In other words, their Lagrangian might be very complicated. It's a messy Lagrangian, like Mary showed yesterday, or like I showed earlier. But the answer tends to be simple, and so if you're trying to do the same game, you were playing the same game with pions. It's sort of hopeless in a way. It's quite complicated. So yeah, I'm sort of going off tangent, but yeah. So this is just a trick. Let's just think of it as a trick for the moment. So now I'm trying to probe the analytic structure. So like once I shift this K1 by K1z and K2 by K2z, I can partition it in different ways. So like I can have K1 in one direction, one side, like one side, and K2 in the other direction. So then it builds a propagator in between. So there's a propagator in between, just like in the Feynman diagrams, but these are not actually Feynman diagrams. There would be a propagator. And so what would be the structure of the propagator? So this would be a propagator. So I can sort of rewrite this. The propagator is a function of z, because k1 has like a z in there. And so if k1 and k2 are in the same side, then it won't have any kind of particles that are flowing inside. But if I put them in two different sides, then there's actually a ZQ that is flowing inside the propagator. And so this would be the structure of the propagator. And then I know exactly where the pole is. The pole is there, here, like ZP is equal to P 0 square 2 ZQ dot P. Okay? And so P, so I know exactly where the poles are. And the goal here is to actually extract the whole scattering amplitudes by looking at the poles. The poles are actually the important thing in this game. So whenever you have some A of Z, the way I think about it is think in terms of Cauchy's theorem, and that's exactly what BCFW did. So you can actually calculate the physical amplitude by using Cauchy's theorem. You calculate this as sum of residues of AZ over Z. Now, of course, there could be a pole from infinity, and in order to play this game, in order to actually calculate the scattering amplitudes in terms of the sum of these poles, what you have to ensure is that these infinities don't contribute, because there could be an infinity, the pole from infinity that contributes. So we want to make sure that there is no infinity that is contributing to this, to this A of Z. Now it turns out that this is the fascinating thing about scattering amplitudes of gravitons and gluons, that the pole does not contribute from infinity. There's no actual pole that is from infinity, so I can get rid of this and I can rewrite this as the residue of AZ over Z. So that's the essential property of these amplitudes. So maybe I should be a little bit more pictorial here. So if you have K1, K2, so here's a five-point amplitude that I'm actually studying. So how I can write this is I can shift this k1 by k1 of z, and then k2 by k2 of z. And then I can evaluate this. So you have k1. So I can partition it so that k1 and k2 are in two different directions. So like here's one of these, and there's another one of this. These are not Feynman diagrams anymore. These are what you call BCFW diagrams. It's just a pictorial representation, but these are not Feynman diagrams. So here, like evaluated at that pole, which was actually an off-shell quantity, like I factorize this and this becomes on-shell. This propagator becomes on-shell. So you can so what this method really is it's sort of like a green method, right? So it's a green method in a sense that you can start with a five-point amplitude. You rewrite this as a product of a four-point and a three-point amplitude, and then you already have this four-point amplitude. You can reduce this down to a three-point amplitude, a product of two three-point amplitude. So like the most fundamental entity in this theory, like if you think of your quantum field theory in terms of scattering amplitudes, is a three-point amplitude, because you can reduce it down to the three-point amplitude, which is the most irreducible thing that you can actually construct. So three-point amplitudes can construct all the S matrix for you. Okay, so that's really what BCFW did. Now somebody the one begs the question, like can you actually do the same thing for loops? This is a bit of an aside, and it turns out that there are certain kind of problems with loop. For instance, if I were to make a cut here, here's a loop. So just to remind you, these are external particles, and so in a loop diagram, if you were to do scattering amplitudes for loop diagrams, what you have to do is integrate over the inside of the loop, right? So you have to actually integrate over these internal momenta. So if you were to, like, there are a couple of problems with doing these kind of recursion relation with the loop amplitude. The first problem is you're integrating over this inside, so you don't know where it starts from. There's absolutely no reason why, I mean, L plus ZU1, you can always shift that, and you can actually do your regularization, it doesn't really matter where your L starts from, because you're integrating over this L. So you have to decide where to make a cut, for instance. And so if you were to make a cut here, there's a possibility that this one is going to be L, then this other side is going to be minus L. And so if you were to write this as a tree-level diagram and use this BCFW, in other words, you factorize this in terms of like 3-point, like 5-point in terms of 4-point, 4 points in terms of 3 points, what can happen is L and L minus L can come together. So there's actually something known as a forward limit. So there's no momentum transfer. So you have to make sure that those things are taken into account for. This is a bit of an aside because I thought it would be useful to actually sort of express this. But people have worked on this, and there are a lot of groups who have been thinking about this. And these things seem to work with mostly very well for a particular kind of theory, like n equals 4 Sobrian-Mills theory. These things have been worked out for the integrand of these theories. Okay, so here is that's really my first part, and I'm going to go and talk about ADS, and I'm going to use some of these techniques to actually explain how we can understand scattering amplitudes in ADS. But the moral to this point is that just because you have a simple Lagrangian, like the simplest Lagrangian that you can get is probably phi to the fourth theory or something of the sort. Just because you have a simple Lagrangian, like a scalar field theory, doesn't mean that your S matrix or your scattering amplitudes is actually simple. Like it turns out, like for instance, as witnessed by some of the examples that you've seen from Park and Taylor amplitudes and so forth and so on, that's actually the Young-Mills or Young-Mills amplitude are actually much more simple. And it sort of seems to persist for some kind of supersymmetric particles as well. So I'll stop here like to take some questions, and then I'll move on to ADS if you have any questions to this point. Any questions? Yes?
So sort of your third point here, if it's stunning that gauge theories and gravity have this property, does that mean that there's a underlying significance? That is, there's a statement that the symmetry is enforcing something in particular you can point at to say this is why the amplitudes look simple? Or is that still an open question?
People much cleverer than I am tend to think that maybe, like, so I've asked this question to Nima, and so he said the answer that he seems to sort of like is that maybe graviton or gluons are more fundamental. Now that's sort of escaping the answer, of course, I understand, right? As opposed to having a scalar field theory. So we don't know that, like, I don't know. That seems to be sort of like the answer that I've been, I mean.
Is that in that last paper, or is that?
So this is exactly the paper.
Okay.
So this is where I have sort of like, this is where this sort of like started from, in a sense, that what is the simplest quantum field theory?
Yeah.
Not phi to the fourth theory, but probably, you know, n equals to four. Like their argument there was the n equals to four was the simplest quantum field theory because the scanning amplitudes were simple, so simple. And also this is true for loop amplitudes as well, especially for n equals to four, which for n equals to four, all the loop amplitudes for all order has been actually written down for the integrand. Of course, there is problems with actually, like I said, you still have to integrate, right? And that's another mess. But still, it's a non-trivial thing that people have done, that they've actually calculated recursively all the integrands. Yes.
The second actual closed form that you showed us was on too fast for me to see, but it looked like it was something like bracket 1, 2 closed bracket raised to the 6 to 4.
4, yeah, 1, 2.
Divided by bracket 1, 2, bracket 2, 3, etc.
Yes.
Bracket 5, 6. Is
yeah.
that correct?
Yes.
So if it's so simple, can you write down what it is in general?
Yes, I can. So for something, yeah, I can write it down right here.
Is it 1, 2?
1, 2, yep. So if you have, for let's say if you have, can everybody see this?
Yeah.
So let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, and then N.
And that's not a loop in the middle,
it's just a black box,
everything that can be.
Absolutely, put. Yeah. Okay. So like this is like a scattering amplitude. Two particles going in, or maybe three particles going in, something else.
What we used to call
S-matrix, yes. Absolutely. So this, the answer to this is 1, 2, 3, 4, n-1, n.
And these?
And there's one caveat. This has minus one minus. This is minus negative polarization. These are known as NHB amplitudes. And so,
that minus polarization.
Yeah, two of them have to have minus polarization. Everything else has to have positive polarization. Or you could flip that.
And the expression inside is a k dot some kind of spin or
chirality vector. So what these are known as spinner helicity variables.
Yes.
So these are just basically. You can think of this as dot product of momentum. Some dot product of momentum. Like it could be.
Momentums or momentum dot?
Or polarization vector.
Polarization
vector. Yeah, so it could be a combination of that. You could rewrite a polarization vector in terms of this as well. So this is like the simplest, cleanest way of writing this. All of these are just kinematic variables right now.
And that's it. This is after integrating over everything.
Well, like this is loop. This is tree level, so you don't have to integrate over the internal.
Yeah. So it's a function of n momentums k.
That's right. Now the one thing that I'm hiding is, of course, these are gluons. There are colors here.
Yeah.
But those can be stripped out. But that's the final answer. This is a closed form answer that Park and Taylor first discovered. These are known as Park and Taylor amplitudes. All right. So. Any other questions?
What was green was about the kind of bootstrapping.
The green was to, like, so the answer itself was simple.
Yeah, and you can use
the recycle. So, like, if you have a, like, n particle, then you can rewrite it as a product of a n minus one, like, particle amplitudes of n minus one, times the product of three-point function. And you can do that recursively. Any other questions? Okay. So I'm going to take a jump now. So I'm going to talk about, ADS, okay? I've covered all the flat space and I'm just going to take a jump in.
It's a star question. If I remember correctly, Park and Taylor didn't directly calculate it, but they did a supersymmetry calculation and took a limit, correct?
That's right.
So they were already leveraging.
They used supersymmetry to do this calculation.
Yeah.
Now, this is very interesting. At tree level, supersymmetric amplitude is exactly as no supersymmetry. Now, at loop level, so if you were to like think about it, if you were to think about some kind of a diagram, you can reduce for n equals to 4, let's think about the simplest possible, like the maximal supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, then you can decompose this in terms of something known as a box diagram and a triangle and so forth and so on. Now, for n equals to 4, there's a theorem known as no triangle theorem. That means that the triangles don't contribute to your amplitude. So n equals to 4 is very simple, but that's at loop level. But at tree level, you know, like the it's the same. So they use supersymmetry, as you say correctly, but that made the calculation simple. But these are exactly the same thing. Yeah. So I'm going to take a leap here, and I'll talk about. So motivated by this, so I was thinking about these scattering amplitudes, and I was thinking about the loop amplitudes. And so there are a couple of questions that I was interested in. I wanted to understand how these progress in scattering amplitudes can help us understand ADS-CFT. Or like some questions, what are the observables in ADS-CFT? So I'll give you a very, very heuristic sort of bird's eye view of what ADS-CFT is. It's a precise formulation. So like the probably a better name is gauge gravity duality. It's a precise formulation of a gauge and a gravity duality. Anti-de Sitter space and conformal field theory duality. That's what ADS-CFT stands for. ADS is anti-de Sitter space. It's a particular kind of a solution to Einstein's equation with a negative cosmological constant. And then there's a duality between this ADS, which lives inside here, and there's a quantum field theory that lives in the boundary, which is a conformal field theory. It's conformal invariant field theory. And so there's a duality between these two theories. So this conformal field theory that lives in the boundary is a strongly coupled field theory. So some of you are in condensed matter physics. So you know this gives you a handle of dealing with actually strongly coupled systems. All right. And so you can answer questions about what is in the boundary, these quantum field theory that lives in the boundary, by answering questions inside. So in a sense, it's a holographic duality. What does that mean? So here, as you can see, the space-time inside is, if the space-time inside is d plus 1, the one at the boundary is going to be a d dimension. And this is the famous paper by Malasina. Just a bit of pictures. I was very envious of a lot of your talks, because you can put in more talk pictures than I can. So it's sort of motivated by the idea of ADS-CFT. Sort of is motivated by this holographic duality. The entropy of black hole, as most of you probably know already, is proportional to the area of the horizon. And this is probably the most beautiful equations in all of physics. Well, maybe definitely in the last 50 years. The entropy is actually proportional to the area. It has all the things that we love and know in physics. It has the Boltzmann constant. It has the speed of light. It has the Planck constant. It has quantum mechanics, and it has gravity. And it has a funky factor of 4 as well, which is even more interesting. And it's a property unlike any other system. So the ADS-CFT is a realization that space-time in general, like not just a black hole, the degrees of freedom of the space-time is also that lives at the boundary of the space-time. And that's what ADS-CFT is. At the very boundary, there's some kind of a quantum field theory for this. So my question that I'm going to sort of gloss over, and I'll just give you a bird's eye view, is that can we use the same sort of things that we have made progress in this scattering amplitudes in flat space in order to actually understand ADS-CFT duality? And so there are many interesting features of this ADS-CFT, but then just like in the case of the scattering amplitudes in flat space, we have these Feynman diagrams. If you want to calculate these correlation functions at the very boundary of this quantum field theory, which is the conformal field theory, there's a prescription to do these, and these are known as Witten diagrams. They're exactly analog to Feynman diagrams, just exactly analog to Feynman diagrams in the case of ADS-CFT. So you can use these Witten diagrams to actually calculate what is an analog to scattering amplitudes in ADS-CFT. Now, so I'll give you an anatomy of how these Witten diagrams, or if you don't like the word, if that confuses you, just think of Feynman diagrams in ADS-CFT. They're propagators in these ADS-CFT. So there's one propagator. So you can think this circle as the horizon or the boundary of ADS, and inside this is the bulk. This is where the gravity lives. This is where the quantum field theory lives. Okay? There are two kinds of propagator. One is known as the bulk. Bulk is inside. Bulk to boundary propagator. And there's another kind of propagator which is known as bulk to bulk propagator. And so how do you calculate amplitudes? So what you're trying to do is calculate these correlation functions at the boundary. And so there's a prescription, which is this Witten diagrams. And so how do you calculate this? You calculate this by joining these Witten diagrams. But I want to make a brief sort of a side remark here. In general, like if you have a generic field theory, just a very, very general field theory, in flat space, and you're doing the calculation using, let's say, Feynman diagram prescriptions. You could do these calculations in two different ways. You can do it by using momentum space, or you can do it in configuration space. Anybody sane never does calculation. Well, maybe it's necessary. I shouldn't say this. Usually, it's not very very desirable to actually do calculations by using configuration space. But in principle, you can do this. So you can calculate a Green's function like this, and it's some Bessel function, and it looks like this ugly square root. And then you take a Fourier transform, and that's what we teach our students as well. And it becomes really nice. You know exactly where the poles are. You know momentum. You can see like these are two momentums coming in, and it makes sense. It makes more intuitive sense. That's part of the reason why Feynman diagrams are actually useful. So in general, like you have to find the right sort of basis in order to do these calculations. And that's true in physics in general. You have to calculate, like some nature does not care about basis, but we do, and so like some of these calculations actually are useful like by doing a Fourier transform. Now, I wanted to study ADS amplitude. First of all, the way I wanted to do it was actually try to do the recursive calculation, just like in the case of a flat space. But so at that point, I didn't get anywhere, but then I found this really nice sort of transform that I learned from Miguel Paulos. And so there's a nice sort of transformation. It's sort of like a Fourier transformation, but not a not exactly. It's known as a Mellin transform. So if you have some kind of, let's not focus on the details, but it's you can think of it as a sort of like a Fourier transform for these ADS amplitudes, and then the answer becomes simple. Like again, like if you were to do these calculations in configuration space, like you get all these hybrid geometric functions, and it makes you really miserable, and then you drink more coffee, and it makes you more miserable. And so, but then you can do a transformation, which is this Mellin transformation that makes your answer quite a bit simple. I'll show that in a little bit. There's another thing that you can do, like you can change this sort of a formalism in which you can do this ADS calculation, which is known as the embedding formalism, and that makes the calculation a little bit simple as well. What happens is this P is the boundary point, this X is the point inside the ADS, and so it sort of decomposes as a dot product of P dot X. There's another thing that happens. The hard part about doing these calculations in ADS, calculating scattering amplitudes in ADS, is that there is this bulk-to-bulk propagator. And so like, if you were to do these calculations in without taking it into this sort of formalism known as an embedding formalism, the calculations are much harder. But if you were to do this calculation in embedding formalism, what happens is there's some kind of a factorization. Now, this is interesting because it sort of is reminiscent, like initially when I saw this, it was sort of reminiscent to this BCFW recursion relation where I used this Green method in a way, right? So like there was factorization of a three-point in terms of, sorry, factorization of four-point in terms of two three-points and so forth and so on. In the same way, you know, like if you have this propagator that is factorizing, a lot of answers become a much more simple and you can do your integrations much easier. So here's a simple example. So this is a three-point amplitude in ADS. So you have P1 and X. X is a bulk point. P1, P2, and P3 is a point at the boundary. So this is the simplest thing you can do calculations. And what happens, like once you, like, I'm not going to go through details here, although I made a mistake of putting it here, you can integrate over these things and you can actually get final form answer. This was actually first done by these people. The important thing here is that when you calculate these scattering amplitudes using this sort of transform, which is known as the Mellin transform, you see this delta ij? That's probably the only thing that you should really focus on. These delta ij acts as if they're like Mandelstam invariants. So if you've actually calculated scattering amplitudes, there are these S12 that you see, or depending on the channel you use, there are S12, or which is a dot product of momenta, 2k1, k2 or something. If you take this transform, this Mellin transform, in order to calculate correlation functions in ADS, it seems to come out in this form, which is delta ij, which is really nifty. And it sort of has it is very reminiscent of scattering amplitudes, Mandelstam invariants. Yes?
So I don't know if you said the word out loud, but on one of your slides, when you were doing the morals from the first part, you yep. said the word, it was written the words light cone.
Yeah.
So is this, and if I remember right, I mean, there is a Mellin transform in Minkowski space that people can use to transform some observables to the light cone observable. I mean, is this the same?
Okay, so I know what you're talking about in the case of light cone. There are a couple of places I use light cone in different contexts. Okay. This, what I call this embedding formalism, is also a light cone sort of coordinates in a way. the I didn't use the word light cone, maybe I should have emphasized it. At that context, when I say a light cone, that was to sort of, I told you, like, it's actually an answer to the question that you asked earlier. Like, what is the physical meaning of this BCFW at that point? And I had this ZQ that I added to this momenta. Now, like, in order to show that these are these heavier particles in a gas of gluons that were propagating, these people who are actually calculating BCFW recursion relation, the paper, or giving a physical interpretation of BCFW recursion relation, used light cone gauge, but it's true in general. Now, to answer your question, I don't know what you just said. Like, so you said that there is actually
right.
So that was the that was to clarify. But
there's a guy named Wayne Polyzoo who does quantization in light, who does nuclear physics by quantization and light cone gauge.
And he takes it to Mellon transform.
And he uses the Mellon transform.
Okay.
As how you convert.
No, that's interesting because like here we use a light cone coordinate. What I call this embedding formalism is implicitly a light cone coordinate. So I'd be interested in...
You might check it out there.
Okay.
He's written some nice articles.
Yeah. I mean,
very different context.
I really think Mellon transform is sort of underused in physics. I mean, there's a string amplitude that is written in terms of Mellon transform. Like, this is sort of a... I mean, like, we are used to thinking in terms of, you know, momentum space. But I think that those are very interesting things to actually pursue, like, just from a technical point of view. In general, so then like okay, you calculated scalar amplitude, okay, big deal. So you want to do something a little bit more complicated, you can calculate a vector amplitude, and the structure seems to persist. You can have this index that is like it comes out, and then you can rewrite these vector amplitudes. Like if you do you suffer a little bit, then you can write it down in terms of the scalar amplitudes and like these indices sort of factorize. Okay, and so I'm gonna just go through this, and these are just technical things. You can calculate four-point contact diagrams using Mellon transform and embedding formalism. Again, you can use these factorization techniques here, right here, and then also calculate these vector amplitudes. And so, and then this one, it took a lot of time for me to calculate, but one was able to calculate a five-point Witten diagrams, these vector amplitudes propagating inside the bulk. And so there's this factorization property that one can exploit in order to do these calculations. Okay.
So, yes. Question: Is it sort of appropriate to think of these diagrams as I don't know? Let's say the one on the left, a probability for couple of particles emitted from
side
of the boundary, and then.
That's right. Okay. Good. Sorry. Like I should probably have emphasized that. So you can think of this. So in ADS, in the case of S matrix, like there are particles coming from infinity. And then, you know, like something happens in between and then they go off, right? And so, like, you're calculating the scattering amplitudes. Now, there's not exactly, like, that sort of idea of S matrix in the case of ADS. You can think of ADS as a box, right? So what you can do is, like you just, like, wiggle something in the ADS. Like, you change some conditions here. And so one of the way of thinking about it is actually just calculating some correlation functions at the very boundary. But the other way of calculating it, or other way of thinking about it is actually calculating something inside of the like use the metric, like use these Witten diagrams to do those calculations, and those are equivalent, and that's what Witten figured out in his paper, in his famous paper in 98. Yes.
I'm sure this is incredibly naive, but when I look at these two diagrams, I see there's the interior point on the interior propagator on the right hand side that then connects outward.
Yeah.
When I look on the left, I kind of feel like there should be two points on the outside.
Okay, good.
But there must be, is there something topologically with how these things are connected?
So this is just a calculation tool more than anything else. So you see this is the actual diagram.
Yeah.
This 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And these are just like Feynman-like diagrams. And so what happens is there's an internal propagator here. So I just factorize this. As I said, there was this embedding formalism. And I just factorized this. So I rewrote this as a product of a three-point right here and a four-point right here.
Oh, so you can do 4 points.
Yeah. So and I've already done 4 points. Yeah. And I've already done 4 points. So my job is done there. So I can just patch them together and get the...
And you kind of have a similar thing then happening over there. You've
That's
got
exactly
a four-point at the top and a three-point at the
top. And so this four-point is a different kind of a four-point. Like in a Young-Mills theory, there's a contact diagram as well.
Uh-huh.
And so there's another kind of a 4 point. So these make the exhaustive list of all the prime. And then, like, of course, if you want to calculate the whole amplitude, you have to add all the width diagrams together. Any questions? Any more questions? All right. And then, so I started like thinking about this, and I recently I've gone back to the original question that I asked. So I used this Mellon transform to do calculations because those was a nice formalism. And so I'm just gonna, well, part of the reason I asked Don to actually make my talk towards the end was I was hoping that I would finish this calculation and show it to you. But you know how that goes, right? So,
yeah.
As I told you, the correlation functions can, you can take a Mellon transform, but you can also take a good old Fourier transform and take it to the momentum space. Right. But then there, you can use like the same sort of techniques. And so this was pioneered by Raju. And so I'm also doing this work with a Hendrik student. His name is Klaus Schaka, very, very, very good student. And so we made some progress, but it still needs a little bit of massaging, I think. And so we're working on it. But there seems to be there are two things that we're trying to do. First, we're trying to look at what is an equivalent to this MHV amplitude, and if there's a structure like an MHV amplitude in the case of ADS. So you can like define these two polarization vectors as negative and then like the rest of them positive. And you see like there's this really nice structure in the case of flat space. So one can in principle do these calculations in ADS. Right now the answers are not as satisfactory as, I mean, there's an expression that I've figured out, but it's not as nice, but we're working on it. But there seems to be some kind of a recursive relation by like doing the complex shift and using a similar technique like BCFW with a slight sort of like a change version of BCFW. But the idea is calculating these correlation functions in anti-de Sitter space using their analytic properties. Okay, so that's, yes.
Does that second sentence need a different punctuation? Like
this, the punctuations in this, which one? One of the things that we're looking at is in flat. Yeah, this is bad. This is what happens, as you said, when you try to fix a slide over lunch.
Okay.
So
one of the things is in flat space, amplitudes that have factorization properties may factorize in ADS.
That's right.
Okay.
That's
so
right.
We're not flattening ADS space.
We're not flattening ADS space. Okay. Right. Now, the other thing that is interesting that, like, when you say this, if you have two negative helicity and the rest of them are positive, then I get a simple answer, right? But if you had all positive helicity, that's zero. You could have millions of Feynman diagrams, you add them up, that's zero. In ADS, they don't vanish. Yeah, they don't vanish.
Is that an easy physical reason why they have to vanish?
I don't know what the physical reason is. I mean, it's really funny thing about these amplitudes that at loop level, they don't vanish, though, like for pure Young Mills. And for supersymmetric Young Mills, they vanish. So there's not a simple answer to why they vanish. But the all positive or all negative helicity amplitudes for gluons, boom.
But you know it's complicated because that's for gluons, it's not for Young Mills.
For gravitons as well as gluons, they tend to vanish. I mean, like to write the graviton amplitude, I mean, of course, it's really complicated.
Yeah, because but, you don't have
that's right, and you have more contact diagrams. Like, it's not just four contact diagrams. You could have 5, 6, 7, and it can go on forever. And so you have to use a particular kind of gauge called de Donder gauge, which is a useful way of doing those calculations. But then in the end, they tend to vanish as well. So anyway, so we've thought about this and we made some progress. We know for a fact that this does not vanish. Like if you have ADS amplitudes or ADS correlation functions. Okay. So here's the conclusion. We have used the embedding formalism to make ADS integral much easier. And using the combination of embedding formalism and Mellon transform, you can see that these ADS amplitude are much more crisp. They act, they're a function of some kind of a Mandelson invariance and so forth and so on. Here's the outlook. So as I said, there is a miraculous simplicity in the structure of scattering amplitudes, which has led to new tools that can be applied across the board. And the simplicity allowed, of course, there's a reason to actually try to understand physics in colliders like LHC and so forth and so on. But you can tell a lot about your theory, because these are the observables of your theory. If you're looking at ADS, these correlation functions, those are your observables of your theory. Because I think it was Alex who said that, you know, like, the physics is all about studying observables. Like, there, everything else is formalism. And so it's important to try to understand what your observables are. And so these are, like, for if you're studying ADS-CFT as a model of your theory of quantum gravity, it's important to sort of try to understand what they're telling you. And so they seem to have nice mathematical properties, and, you know, like, it simplifies with some kind of basis and so forth and so on. Here are future tangible goals. Maybe the Grapton loop amplitude is really not so tangible. And so there are also recent interest in higher. I don't know why I put there. I don't want to do it. I know that. Graviton and higher spin theories in ADS-CFT. There are other things like try to get a flat space limit for ADS. And this field has been really growing. There's all kinds of mathematical structures, like, you know, like, there are other kinds of transform, like twister space, where these amplitudes tend to have very simple properties, and that's what Witten showed in his 2003 really beautiful paper in 2003. And so there are questions like locality and things of that sort. People like Joe Polchinski at KITP, they're thinking about these questions. And so, like, I see this as a technology to use and try to understand these questions. Now, the euphoric dream is to see, like, how this kind of idea can, calculating correlation functions in ADS can help us understand black hole information paradox. Now, this is like, you can think of a black hole as particles coming in, and you can think of a black hole as a scattering process in some sense. There are particles coming in, there's some intermediate state, and then it's sort of the final state is black hole evaporation. It's sort of like a scattering amplitude. So maybe understanding the observables in quantum gravity is important to understand black hole information paradox. There are other things like understanding correlators for during the period of inflations. I mean, these are all sort of like, there are people working many of these aspects using some of the tools from scattering amplitudes. The curvature of ADS sort of seems to be like acting like a regulator. Tuft was one of the first person, I think, to think about this. Maybe there's deeper meaning to this. So those are the questions that I'm interested in. This problem that's like the problem with ADS. Oh, sorry, Tom.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to end with some of the things that I've been doing. I did at Hendricks College my first year. So these are my students. They're really happy here, and they're doing a different project. I don't know why they're so happy. I don't think I inflicted enough pain upon them. we're doing so with these kids. I'm doing a project on biophysics. Probably I should have given a talk on biophysics, but I'm still learning, so I don't want to be exposed completely, so I didn't give a talk, but maybe in the next meeting. And Claude is a very bright kid, and so he's actually doing a lot of calculations, and he's made a lot of progress. And so, like, he's a Rwandan scholar, Faisal is from Palestine, so, like, I have a good group of very interesting sort of perspective, and these kids have been a lot of fun to work with. So that's where I'll end, and time for barbecue. There's a blackboard here, right? Thanks.
It's like a pretty bad physics lecture. You know when that ball comes back,
I don't know.
Somebody gave me it's black hole evaporation.
Right, yeah.
The final burst of gamma ray.
Any questions or?
Does this solve the firewall problem?
No.
Is it a problem?
What problem?
Firewall. That's the right.
Yeah. Well, that's another story. I mean, the answer, the simple answer to that question is, thinking of black holes is because sort of I feel like I studied scattering amplitudes, so like maybe it's useful. And there are people who have worked on similar problems, but to be honest, I haven't delved too much into black hole information paradox. Yes.
Does the dimensionality of your ADS space have any bearing on what you're doing?
For the one, the calculation I've done for ADS using Mellin amplitudes, mm-hmm. That's for all dimensions. The calculations that I'm doing for recursive recursion relation, that's a really very thoughtful question. That's for ADS 4 CFT 3. So like that's for a three-dimensional CFT. Great. Any other questions? Yeah.
So I have a general question, sort of inspired by what you said. Anyone else run across the Mellon transform in their research?
Yeah, it's used to evolve parton distribution functions from a very low scale at which you think you have your model, and then take account of all the splitting processes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that's one of the biggest criticisms of the parton distributions that are used at the LHC, is that they're very dependent on the way in which you do those evolution equations. Some of them are done directly with coupled integral and differential equations, and others are done by Mellon transforms.
There is also, like, if you do loop calculations, like higher loop calculations, there's something known as Mellon Barnes that you use that there as well. So there's the other applications.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of not really in physics, but
Number theory.
And there's stuff that I've done on sort of embedding zeta functions to certain quantum systems where the zeta function has a very physical interpretation.
Right.
But I'm not sure that's
more
than just the mathematics of the Mellon transform coming in with
the factorization.
That's
the
splitting. Mary's is much more physical.
But there's also, I mean, that's a sort of a factorization in the sense that you take something and it.
Yeah.
The probabilities factor.
It relates so much to all the statistical and probability discussions we've been
having.
It's very beautiful mathematics.
It's true. Like in number theory, like there's if you have some L functions that comes out of people using Fermat's last theorem, trying to elliptic curves and things of that sort. That
I'm just wondering if there's a good physics review of applications of the Mellon.
Yeah, that would be a good review to write if somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. 1 year.
Yeah. Well, there are probably other applications, you know, scattered here, there.
Right.
It's not like Fourier that everybody learns, when they're 2 years old.
Yeah.
But the number theory tells me that you take a logarithm of whatever it is, and then you got the Mellon.
I mean, these transforms are, in a certain sense, right? All these transforms are the same.
But
they're not.
Yeah.
And in general, like for conformal field theory, like which has ADS dual or not, Mellon transform seems to be a natural sort of space to work on.
It would be interesting if there's any also connection to zeta function regularization sort of lurking in the background. I don't know. I mean, I've never seen that, but it would, it's not impossible.
The way you're all talking makes me think that I'm remembering something wrong. This all sounds crazy compared to with the application I've seen of it. I can't see how it's all related to what I thought I was talking about. Is there like a watermelon transform?
No. I was just going to point it out that at the barbecue there will be a melon transform. Because James has bought a watermelon and right now it's green and we're going to cut into it and make it pink.
Cut it again.
You should see this watermelon.
Watermelon and proto flower.
I think we're hitting the silly season.
And Alex is probably very lonely.
Since I'm the last speaker, I want to make one last comment. I think on behalf of everybody, I think we should thank all the organizers, Herb.